You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Brian Callen Show, which once again features no Brian Callen because the kid is auditioning for a big Hollywood blockbuster, which I probably am not even allowed to talk about because it's so big that it has to be kept secret, much like Area 51. On today's podcast, we have Sarah Ashley Bird, and we also have Professor Werner Salores from Harvard University. Professor, you have recently written a book that I absolutely adored. Thank you, Sarah, for the recommendation, called The Temptation of Despair. Would you mind telling us a little bit about why you wrote this book?
I've always been interested in areas of cultural history that are a little bit outside of the limelight. And it struck me that the period between the end of World War II and the founding of West and East Germany and then the economic miracle and the consolidation and the Cold War was a bit of a no man's land. You had the war and the Holocaust history ending in 45, and then something new that really takes off in the 50s. But the period right after the war seemed to be murkier. And so I was curious about how documents from the period itself, diaries, fiction, photography, films, represented the moment of the end of World War II, the Allied occupation of Germany, the first democratic elections, dealing with the history of the Holocaust, all of those very big issues, and the effect of the bombing campaign and of the relocation of large numbers of people. So that's what I focused on in the book, which uses exclusively sources from the period 1944 to 1952.
Because as Americans, you know, World War II occupies a very special place in our hearts. You know, it's really a good war. It's a war we can feel good about. You know, we don't have the conflicted feelings that we have about World War I or Vietnam or certainly the most recent wars, the war on terror in Iraq and Afghanistan. And part of that sort of what you talk about is that myth of World War II that we have, that, you know, as soon as the war was over, that the Germans were all universally happy to be occupied, that we were, you know, that the Germans were collectively bad and that we as the Allies were basically blameless and conducted ourselves perfectly. And there are a lot of problems with that narrative, correct?
Right. Yeah. The main problem, I think, in our period is the one that you've already alluded to, that it's looked at as a lesson that one could easily repeat, that, you know, just the occupation of other countries will lead to a building up of the democracy. But, of course, the German history was quite special. Germany had had a functioning democracy, had been a nation state at that point, you know, for, well, it depends on what you count from, but at least for 80 years. And so that it was a return to a democratic framework rather than a form of nation building from scratch. So the idea that one can copy that model and just impose it on other areas of the world seemed to me pretty, untenable, I would say.
Well, and I mean, even the vocabulary around the war on terror, right, we referred to the axis of evil. I mean, we very much still think of, you know, every war in terms of our great success, World War II.
Right. Yeah, absolutely right. I mean, metaphor of axis, of course, goes back to that, and the idea also of having alliances in the sense of allies that weren't like the allies in World War II, but, you know, sometimes what was it called, the coalition of the willing, you know, so somewhat more ramshackle groups of you know, small donor countries that contribute something to an American war effort.
And I mean, there are so many great quotes in the book, but some of the ones that I love the most were about the conflicted feelings of the Germans themselves, because, you know, everybody was really sort of finding out. I mean, some people already knew, but, you know, sort of collectively as a species, we really found out about the Holocaust only after the war was over. We came to fully understand the extent of it. And so then the conflicted feelings of the German people about, obviously, they weren't proud of the Nazis and they weren't proud of what had happened in that period. But at the same time, no people wants to be occupied.
Yeah, I think I agree. The difficulty was recognizing the full extent of what had happened because, you know, while many books have been written about complicity of everyday life in Germany with the Holocaust, but the complicity did not extend to a full knowledge of what was happening. Mm-hmm. And 1945, with a big barrage of movie footage, with whole, you know, villages being taken to Allied tents where they were shown documentaries and the radio programs constantly bringing news about, you know, what happened in this concentration camp, that concentration camp, then the Nuremberg trial, you know, bringing the whole thing to the forefront, I think made the whole country much more aware than I had anticipated when I started working on this period of the extent of the horror, so that you can say there was a first encounter with the history of the Holocaust right in 1945 and going through the 40s.
And there, one of the quotes that I really, really loved was, there's this great quote from Eisenhower, which is, the common sentiment Eisenhower gave expression to was, "We are told that the American soldier does not know what he was fighting for. Now at least he will know what he is fighting against."
Yeah.
There's a narrative, I think, that floats around, you know, in sort of our reimagining of the past, where we think, oh, we knew from minute one the Nazis were bad and that they were doing these horrific things to, you know, the Jews, the gypsies, the homosexuals, the political dissidents, and that, you know, therefore it was this very morally clear war as early as, you know, 1939. But of course, that's not the case, because the U.S. didn't enter into the war until it was attacked in 41. And it was, and so the understanding of World War II was something that really was constructed after, you know, the revelation of these concentration camps.
Right, I agree. So the you know, the idea of finding an opponent who makes whatever you do, you know, by comparison, relatively mild and tolerable, I think was a wonderful find, and you gave that Eisenhower passage as an illustration. I think Martha Gellhorn wrote a novel called Point of No Return, and where that's the whole center point as well, that the soldiers recognize when they are involved in the liberated camp of Dachau, and they see the bodies, that, you know, compared to what they had seen and had themselves been involved in, this was so much more atrocious that one all of a sudden felt righteous and even had a sense of revenge against anonymous people that lived outside of the camp. So I think it was also a moment that generated enormous emotions of righteousness, of guilt, you know, of course, also of survival, of loss, because so many people had lost relatives and friends, and you know, so all these very, very deep emotions come to the fore in those texts and images of the period.
And that goes a long way to, you know, constructing that narrative, because there are obviously, in terms of building that narrative of a righteous war, it becomes important to delete from the record, from our public consciousness, the things that the Allies did wrong. Notably, I mean, you talk a lot about the massive level of rape that was perpetrated on German women by Russian soldiers in particular, although, of course, it wasn't just the Russians, but overwhelmingly the Russians.
Right. Yeah, that, I think, was a chapter, of course, about which there wasn't terribly much of a conversation immediately after the war, but the records from the period itself are really striking. I never have a very good memory of numbers, but I think the figure was 100,000 women in Berlin alone who took a rape treatment at the one hospital that did it in 1945. And the period in which it took place was a very concentrated period from April into May. And then by the time Berlin becomes a four-power city, it has long stopped.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very short period of of rather brutal activities. I mean, the rapes are common, of course, all around when armies invade other countries, but this was a rather massive form of rape, about, you know, which many scholars have worked. And I was interested in a text called Woman in Berlin, which mm-hmm. was actually first published in English, a diary from 1945 that was published in New York and London in 1954, and that dealt with lots of issues, the bombing, the hunger, but most centrally with the experience of rape. And I think it raises the whole question, too, of the Allied cohesion, because in order to remain on the moral high ground, one also had to be silent about not only the Russian actions in 1945, but also about the beginning of the war, because after all, it wasn't Germany alone that attacked Poland, but it was Germany and Russia making a pact, and then the two countries divided Poland and the Baltic states, and that was the beginning of World War II, but that could not be talked about in order to keep the Holy Alliance holy until the Cold War made that superfluous.
Right, right. but again, I mean, you know, for a country like the United States or for any country, you know, countries have principles by which they supposedly live by, and then they're forced to abandon those principles, or whether they're forced to abandon them or not, or whether they choose to abandon them in this, for the sake of expediency in order to get through short-term political objectives.
Mm. Yeah. But, you know, when you look on balance, you can also say that the American occupation was the one that, you know, Germans liked best of the four powers. You had a multiple choice of occupiers, and there were surveys. You know, sociologists' big hour was in the occupation as well, doing secret surveys to measure the climate of the population. And there was no doubt that the Americans were also the only occupying power that in itself had not experienced the horror of a German aggression or occupation. After all, France and Russia, and Russia especially, had experienced a brutal onslaught of the German army in World War II, and England had experienced the Blitz. So the United States was the only country that in itself had not experienced the war on its territory from the German side. I mean, Pearl Harbor from the Japanese was the extent of it. And so therefore, I think there was also much less of a revenge fantasy on the American side. The Americans were certainly the most liked and likable occupying force, and I wrote quite a bit about that too, because for young people, especially the black soldiers, but all American soldiers, their body postures, the casual way they walked, were fascinating and a real big departure in adult conduct. So that there was also a rather amicable story of fraternization and amicable relations between the Americans, especially the British, probably second, but more so with the Americans than with any other occupying force.
Which is sort of a repeat of the terms of the Treaty of Versailles. I mean, you know, the United States not having been directly impacted on its home soil by the war is able to take the most understanding, empathetic stance towards the German people rather than, you know, obviously if you're in a state of war, these narratives start to develop and you start to dehumanize the enemy and you start to think of them as all evil. And then that affects the way in which you, you know, conduct the post-war terms and the way that you conduct the post-war occupation.
Right. No, that's absolutely true. Yeah.
I mean, I think that's what's so interesting about this. I mean, would you mind telling us why you called the book The Temptation of Despair?
Well, I had expected more. I was thinking at the beginning of really just focusing on the American occupation and having chapters that would deal with encounters. And I thought of it more, it would develop into a kind of comedy plot. You know, you put 500,000 unmarried or wifeless men into an area that had been heavily bombed and where the food supply wasn't exactly very good, while the army was well stocked and had lots of supplies. So you would imagine that a kind of you know, happy balance of exchange would take place. That Tony Vaccaro has a wonderful story about, you know, the mattress and the sheets, you know, that are traded and end up with a kind of marriage in one of his photo sequences that he had. reading more in the period, I found how many real sad moments there are, how many people were tempted by suicide, how the very word suicide, the German word is Selbstmord, has an absolute peak. You know, if you do a Google n-gram and you plug in the American word or the English word suicide and the German word Selbstmord, you see a completely different curve that peaks in the second half of the 40s. And how many suicides were committed, people really being desperate, being homeless, having lost many relatives, a country also overpopulated now by women, so many men who are still in Russian captivity or who were killed in the war, so that thinking there must be, you know, death is probably better than this kind of life. And the temptation of despair was a phrase that came from Georges Bernanos, who wrote a novel Under Satan's Sun, the center of which is a dialogue between two priests. What can be done to prevent suicidal tendencies? Because the lurid plot is a young girl who commits suicide when she is pregnant and after assaulting one of the men she had slept with. And so the priests have to say, how can one prevent, what can one do to prevent suicide? Their resolution is one has to say, hate the sin, but not oneself as a sinner. And, you know, get rid of the sin. It's a Catholic book. Get rid of the sin, and then you can survive. And I asked myself, what were the antidotes to the widespread feeling of despair? And religion was one that often showed up in the period, or a hope for a more pacifist, socialist future. But I found ultimately that black humor and a kind of dark joke making in the period was also a very important force. You know, people who laugh generally don't commit suicide. So if you laugh at your misery and are capable of standing back and having a black humor joke about it, that's already the first step to re-enter the realm of the living.
And there's the line that the women of Berlin said again and again. Would you mind sharing? I mean, that's a pretty vague reference. I don't know that it's going to be clear what I'm talking about, but do you know the one that I mean?
No, I'm not sure which one.
It's better to have a Russian on your belly than a house
on
your
head. That's about the rapes.
Better
have a Russian on your belly than a Yankee on your head. So, you know, the bombs that fell from the sky were worse to take than the rape is, you know, because you survived the rape generally, although a whole number of women were also killed. Whereas with the bombing, you had the likelihood that you could die in the air raid shelter or just in the street or in the apartment or wherever you were. Although there was black humor jokes about both the rapes as in the Woman in Berlin. You have quite a few of those. Rape humor is a term that she uses. I'd never seen that before. And also about the bombing, there was, you know, one of the diaries I looked at where two prostitutes are talking with this writer, and, you know, one said, the strangest thing happened to me. I left a glass bowl with pudding on the balcony and then went in the air raid shelter. And when I came out, the whole building was gone, but the glass bowl with the pudding was intact one corner down at the next street. But nothing else of her apartment survived. So that, I think, is the kind of black humor joke that makes you reconcile with the loss of your entire possessions, you know, perhaps relatives, certainly friends in the building and so forth.
But at least the pudding was saved.
Pudding was saved, yeah.
One of the things that you alluded to just in a previous answer was about the very particular relationship of the U.S. Army and the German people, because, of course, one of the great ironies of the war is that as Americans were taking the moral high ground about, you know, fighting racism and oppression, they had a deeply segregated army themselves.
Right. Yeah, that was clearly one of the paradoxes. And, you know, probably there's, you know, quite a bit of literature about that from the point of view of the black soldiers, the Germans were relatively non-racist because they were not specifically programmed to hate black soldiers any more than anybody else. And, whereas in the army, being constantly relegated to second rank status or not being able to go to to the same bars where white soldiers could go, you know, never being, always being at risk when they fraternized for some vindictive action, made them, in fact, much more open toward the German population, and especially toward children. I think that's undoubtedly true. American soldiers in general were very nice toward children, but the black soldiers most particularly so. So that there was a relationship, ironically, too, that was something I discovered along the way, that the, you know, since the army didn't put the soldiers into positions of command and not so much into the fighting units, but more into the quartermaster, into the supply units, they had the either the jeeps and the trucks or they had the food supply. So the two things with which one could have the best contact with the German population. You know, if you had access to jeeps and you had access to food, that was the best way to move about and to have exchanges. And this was, I think, as I said before, the expectation I had of a happy fraternization plot. And I think there's quite a bit of that, though the novels that deal with it are not always novels that result in happy marriages, but they do have utopian moments of these kinds of relationships.
Well, one of the sections that I particularly loved is, you know, you cite from a novel, I don't remember the name of it, but when Hayes and Ilse go swimming at Wannsee.
Right. Yeah, that's the novel by William Gardner Smith called Last of the Conquerors. And Smith was a Philadelphia-born black GI who wrote for the Pittsburgh Courier and then also used some of his reportage in the novel. So the novel is pretty close to his own experiences after the war. And the utopian scene is going swimming, black soldiers and white women in the public beach of Wannsee in Berlin. And he finds it so particularly amazing because this would have been unthinkable in the United States, even in Philadelphia, where the issue of segregated swimming or integrated swimming would have still been a bit hair-raising. And one of the sad moments I also came across was an African-American bishop lambasting the army in Berlin for admitting black soldiers in the swimming pool in the barracks only mm-hmm. one day a week. And after black soldiers used the pool, the water was let out and the pool was drained and washed before fresh water could come in for the white GIs. So the fear of bodily fluids, you know, transmigrating from a black body to a white body must have been enormous.
There's a quote here from that section of the book that I absolutely loved and I'd love to share with our listeners. I had lain on the beach many times, but never before with a white girl, a white girl. Here, away from the thought of differences for a while, it was odd how quickly I forgot it. It had lost importance. Everyone was blue or green or red. No one stared as we lay on the beach together, our skins contrasting, but our hearts beating identically, and both with noses in the center of our faces. Odd it seemed to me that here, in the land of hate, I should find this one all-important phase of democracy, and suddenly I felt bitter.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's what I loved so much about your book is that it really, you know, we have this sort of very simple narrative and this idea of World War II. And that simplicity, I think, is so damaging because we forget that even an event as, you know, that after the discovery of the concentration camps becomes so morally clear,
right.
You know, after, you know, 60 years of history, at the time, there was so much moral and emotional confusion. It, you know, the Russians perpetrated these rapes on these women. You know, they certainly weren't blameless. You know, the Americans have this irony that they are, you know, standing against racism and standing for democracy, but yet, you know, their own army is so deeply segregated. It's a much more complicated story than the one that, you know, we have developed 60 years later.
No, I agree, and that's why I liked particularly Billy Wilder's film, A Foreign Affair, because that seemed so balanced. Billy Wilder was one of the first Americans to go to Berlin when it became a four-power city after the Russian conquest of Berlin, so I think in August of 45, and he talked to a German woman in the rubble, and she, you know, he said, oh, aren't you happy? You know, the utilities are coming back, and have you heard the they're going to turn on the gas and the electricity, so now you can cook yourself a nice meal. And she said, oh, that's good. I'm going to turn on the gas, but I won't light it. And so Billy Wilder said, wait a minute, this woman's going to kill herself. Is this, you know, what's wrong? These people need a comedy. And so he started thinking about doing a comedy, even though at the same time he had edited a documentary on the concentration camp liberations, had denazified members of the German film industry, and most important, had tried to find out what happened to his own mother, who was killed most likely at Auschwitz or in this concentration camp near Krakow. But she had just died, disappeared. He couldn't find out any more details. And yet he was so balanced in his approach of understanding the humanity of people he had to deal with. And I think A Foreign Affair is a wonderful movie that has the murkiness that you were just talking about. It's not so clear-cut, the murkiness of the moment captured really beautifully. And so produced in 1948 and first exhibited in 1948, it was really a pity that the army did not consider the movie, or it was actually the censorship agency did not consider the movie suitable for German audiences, and so therefore it couldn't be shown in Germany until 1977. But that was a film that really showed the ambiguities very, very fully of what is occupation, what is a righteous attitude, what is the good side of the mission, and what are all the problems along with it. And to do that in the form of a comedy, I think, was absolutely brilliant.
And a large part of it is that the Americans, I mean, some of the things that were most shocking to me were the, just, you talked about the screening of the films of the Holocaust, but even those billboards. And you know, would you mind telling us about those and the captions that were on the billboards?
Yeah, I came across that in a book by James Stern called The Hidden Damage, where he writes about a town, Bad Nauheim, near Frankfurt, where the citizens are all congregated around a billboard, and he goes closer and he sees the billboard says, whose fault is it? And there are photographs of bodies in concentration camps, piled up bodies, bones, ashes, all the horror photographs of the concentration camps, and then another set of posters that say, it's your fault, you are guilty, and more sharply developed photographs of concentration camps. And so he wonders what might be going on in people who are just looking at it and who then go home, and when they turn on the radio, they hear more of this. And I found then a photograph in the Imperial War Museum in London that shows a young boy looking at a billboard like that, and you can clearly see the poster that he's looking at. And so the sense of, you know, what was the educational intent and how was it received to confront everyone with this permanent sense of you're guilty, you're at fault. You know, that I think was a rather strange moment in 1945. So they were separate of our army units. And interestingly, too, Stern mentions that in the Russian zone, this wasn't done. The Russians had much more pragmatic approach to, you know, talking about food shortages and communication that worked or didn't work. And then they would play music, including music by Jewish composers on the radio, whereas the Western allies tended to have quite a few of the guilt programs on the radio and these guilt posters. I did find one guilt placard from East Germany, too, but they were much, much rarer than in the West.
And obviously, I mean, that's, you know, it makes sense that there's a desire to denazify the German mindset, and that's the point of these guilt placards. But the question is whether, A, you know, it's fair to impose collective guilt on people, which is a question that you really, you know, wrestle with and explore in the book. And then secondly, whether that's, as you say, from an educational standpoint, whether that's truly effective or not.
Right.
And that's so important in terms of, I think, how we're dealing, for example, with the Arab world, because there is such a tendency, especially on American TV, to sort of make it out as if, you know, the entire Arab world is, you know, backwards and bad and responsible for 9/11, and that, you know, they all have to abandon their ways. And there's really no form of subtlety or attempt to understand. There's no empathy, and there's certainly no dialogue.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you said it at the beginning, the repetition of that story is the problem. You know, there's the famous quip that those who don't know history are bound to repeat it. But I think you can also say those who are trying to repeat history are bound to fail, because history is always based on contingencies and is not really replicable. And one of the very big differences of the American army in 45 was it was a draft army in which there was enormous language talent. So you had quite a few German speakers in the army. Many of them also were emigrants or children of emigrants. So there was a deep familiarity with the territory that they occupied, which of course is not the case at all. And I think you look at an army of, you know, people who in their normal life may have been you know, doctors, lawyers, bricklayers, you know, anything in the world, you get also a much richer array than with a professional army that, you know, can be used in this part of the world or that part of the world. So what I found striking in the accounts of 1945 are also stories of idealistic officers who really, you know, go on a mission. I came across a local election where the American officer was an Armenian-American officer, said, you know, here you will have the chance now to have free elections. The Nazi party cannot run, of course, but all the other parties should be on the ballot. And so the villagers say, you mean you want us to vote communist? And so this American officer says, no, you don't have to vote for them, but they have to be on the ballot. So they say, but we only have three or four communists in the village, and the only one who would run stammers, so he cannot represent the cause. And so the American officer says, no problem, I get a good speaker from the Soviet zone. And he does, so that the elections, the first local elections in this village are really free and include the Communist Party, represented by a good communist representative, and then the, you have maybe six votes for the Communist Party rather than three or four as before. I love this story because it shows, you know, just the agency of one officer who had a vision, you know, let's do this, and he did it. But it sounds like a fairy tale when you tell the story.
Mm-hmm. And so part of the other thing that I think is really important to mention is that, you know, the bulk of your work, it seems like, or a large part of it has been, I mean, you're a professor of African-American literature, correct?
Yes.
And so, you know, part of this book is also very personal for you because, you know, you were one of these children who was in Berlin, or in Germany, rather, not in Berlin, but in Germany during this post-war period.
Right, right. Yeah. And that was my editor who encouraged me to insert a few autobiographic memories. And I've done that every now and then. Certainly, you know, playing in the ruins of Frankfurt was one of those memories, and also having contact with GIs and with black soldiers, particularly who, you know, gave me chocolate, one of the Africans, African Americans who worked for the U.S. Army. Gave me a kind of chocolate that you could not buy in Germany at the time, and I drove my parents crazy by saying, you know, can I please get more of this wonderful chocolate that this man gave me? And they were flabbergasted. So there was a little bit of that. I also have a section on mixed-race children from the black GIs and German women, and there was a famous film called Toxie, made, and that was extremely popular in the early 1950s, and I saw it when I was 9 years old and wanted my parents absolutely to adopt a mixed-race child from that background because I was so intrigued by that film. So now I looked at the film a bit more critically. I looked at the scripts and so forth, but I remembered this yearning and the effect that the film had on me when I was 9 years old. So there were memories of that sort that I included in the book.
And, you know, Sarah Ashley Bird sent me an article, an interview of this book, and, you know, they particularly drew attention to the photo of you holding a black doll.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you know, it's clear that this experience and, you know, the particular relationship between African-American GIs and, you know, the German people, you know, that's really shaped in many ways the focus of your career.
Yeah, and I think it's also, in a broader sense, you know, I think more people who are doing American studies in Germany have written about black music and black literature than in any other European country. Hmm. And, you know, perhaps on a percentage basis, even more than in America for a long time, because that was a deep collective experience of many of my contemporaries who grew up in Germany at the time. So the Black Doll was, you know, this was wasn't that something store bought, but my mother knitted a Black Doll out of remnants of, you know, a little bit of wool from socks and so forth. It had all kinds of different things in it, but it was a doll that I absolutely loved, and you know, that had a name, Maxi, and my mother made it clearly in, you know, thinking about black soldiers who were around the village where we then lived. I loved it also that when we went to the photographer, I took the doll along and wanted to be photographed with it.
Sarah Ashley Bird, do you have any questions for the good doctor?
Well, I was actually wondering if you could speak to if there was an interpretation of racism in the American military from the German perspective. Did they see that as unusual, or was that pervasive in Europe at the same time?
Well, I mean, the contemporary reaction, I think, you know, you can see on the one hand, there's a little bit of a snide thing of saying, you know, here they come and they tell us to be and look at that, you know. So it was, in a sense, the conservatives or the racial conservatives in Germany who would use it as a first opening to say, you know, just look at the mirror instead of always looking at us. On the more liberal side, that was sort of, you know, more the milieu in which I grew up, it was much more, you know, fascination with the difference and being relatively unaware of what went on within the army. You know, for me, I already was advanced in high school and then especially in college when I began to realize the full extent, and not even then the full extent, now when I researched the book it became much fuller, but for example heard about restrictive covenants that the U.S. Army in Frankfurt imposed, you know, in leases, the rule that if you were renting out to soldiers, you could not rent out to black soldiers, you know, so that was just simply written into a lease that was in the apartment buildings near the army camps, or, you know, going to a bar, which were always good bars for music, where, you know, there would be graffiti in the bathroom, you know, monkey go back to the jungle, and then, you know, would be somebody like, I'm proud to be in the jungle, and, you know, sort of dialogues that gave you much more of a sense of the tension. And later, when I was a student, I actually worked a little bit at the Race Relations Center of the Army in Berlin, and when white soldiers misbehaved, they had to sort of spend a weekend with me to hear about you know, misbehaving and how hurtful you know, slurs can be and so forth. But I think in the 40s itself, certainly, I mean, for the general population, it would only be the conservative right that would harp on that point. And otherwise, I think people were pretty oblivious to that because they also thought of black soldiers as relatively rich. They had good clothes, they had food, they drove around in jeeps and trucks. So it was very hard to see it from the outside.
Right. That's really interesting.
And so, I mean, the period of World War II in Germany was really this... And you've drawn a connection in the book to the civil rights movement because, you know, all of these GIs, these African American GIs, get the experience of being treated as equal by whites, by the German people, or at least more equal, and they have the experience of affluence and opportunity and, you know, the experience that's in that novel, right, where you get to lie on a beach with a white girl. I mean, that's an important phase of democracy, as he says.
Yeah. No, I think this Martin Klimke is a historian who made that argument, I think, very compellingly, and I drew on his work, that the experience of a very, very large group of soldiers, because, you know, from the end of World War II up to the civil rights movement peaking, you had hundreds of thousands of black GIs stationed in Germany. So I think, you know, among black men in the post-war period, the most likely country for them to have seen is actually Germany. And so to live in a country where outside of the army camp, and then in the course of the 50s, also increasingly inside the army camp, but outside at the beginning, there is no specific discrimination against African Americans. So experiencing a life that is just a normal life to some extent, but of course in a ruined and defeated country which has its own story to it, that I think gains momentum, that you can see, oh, actually it's pretty nice to do things just normally instead of always having to be doubly conscious of race. There's a very telling episode in Malcolm X's autobiography, of all people, when he goes to Frankfurt and he goes to a camera shop, and he goes into a camera shop and he buys a camera. And he writes, it was the only time in his life that he went into a camera shop, looked at a camera, bought a camera and left, and that was all that was happening. It wasn't like, there's a black guy coming into the camera shop. You know, what is going, is he going to rob us? You know, so that thing was completely absent. And he writes about that just as a form of relief. So I think the experience of normalcy, of a life without specific Jim Crow legislation, I think may have indeed helped along the civil rights movement in the United States, because it was if segregation had ended.
Sarah Ashley Byrd, did you have any more questions?
I think that was my most pressing question, but
do you want to
all
move
fascinating
on?
Work, Dr. Sellers.
Do you want to move on to your second most pressing question?
Sorry, I mean, I would love to know what you're working on next.
Well, I had a whole bunch of smaller projects. I just did a long essay on Mark Twain's novel Pudd'nhead Wilson, which is, you know, the changed siblings of different color, one raised white, one raised black, but although originally by blood composition, they should be the other thing that interested me. And I am now thinking of a new, bigger project that will concern migration, a sort of global migration story. I've always been interested in migrant literature, especially migrants coming to the United States. And now I want to extend it to look at the many, many flows and the really interesting global literature and film about people who have left one country and have migrated to another one. That's the big project I'm thinking of. The last one, and that is a collective enterprise I'm engaged in, is an anthology that would be a fully integrated, racially integrated American literary anthology. So, you know, now we have a black Norton and we have a white Norton, and we are thinking of an anthology that does full justice to the African-American literary tradition, while also including many, many texts by non-African-American authors that in part also deal with racial issues, so that one can see much more of a dialogue from the 18th century through the 20th century. So these are some of the projects that I'm engaged in now.
A busy, busy man. I do want to quickly touch on one word that you used earlier, which I think is really important, and that word is programming. Because I think so much of what the Temptation of Despair draws out is the degree to which, you know, the Germans had been programmed to hate the Jews, but had no specific or no particularly strong programming around you know, dark-skinned people. I mean, obviously there was prejudice. I mean, you know, Hitler refused to shake Jesse Owens' hand at the 36 Olympics.
That actually is a complicated story, because I think the handshaking had already been abolished because there were too many athletes whose hands needed to be shaken. There was the Nazi press on Jesse Owens were actually rather odd in saying it was kind of, it was unfair that somebody who had, you know, like blacks were very good athletes, which, you know, they may have been an inferior race in Nazi thinking, but they were very good athletes. And so it was almost unfair that, you know, somebody like that would win, much more than saying, you know, he is an inferior race and I wouldn't shake hands. There's a really strange newsreel from the German newsreel from the Berlin Olympics when Jesse Owens wins the gold medal, and they don't want to show him on the top of the you know, they always have the three pedestal, and the top pedestal is the gold medal winner. So they just show the auditorium, the whole stadium full of people, and they play the Stars and Stripes, Oh Say Can You See, and the whole stadium, everybody standing up and doing the Hitler salute while it's almost a surrealistic movie. Mm-hmm. So the handshaking thing is a little bit of a myth, I think. Certainly Hitler wasn't happy, he would have. But Hitler, the real big thing was that the International Olympic Committee agreed not to let Jews participate in the Olympics. That mm-hmm. was what was really the big issue. And then, as I said, the Nazi journalists thought it was unfair that black athletes should win this because they were, seemed to be better equipped for that kind of a race.
And so all of this just really goes to draw out the importance of narratives in shaping our thinking, right? There are narratives that are built around the Jesse Owens handshake. There are mm-hmm. narratives that the American people had been, you know, grown up with in terms of African Americans. And there are narratives that, you know, the Germans had grown up with around Jews. And then, you know, now we have the narrative of World War II. And I think what you said about, you know, anybody who doesn't learn from history is doomed to repeat it. Anybody who tries to repeat history is doomed to fail. I think that's really an important lesson.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining us, both of you.
Well, thank you very, very much for this wonderful conversation. And Sarah, it was great to hear your voice.
It was lovely to reconnect with you, Professor. And I'll be looking forward to seeing those integrated Norton anthologies. I hadn't even thought about that until you just brought it up.
All right. Thank you very much.
And whenever you write the Gray Norton, we will be sure to have you back on.
Okay. All right.
And all of Professor Salore's books will also be mentioned in the write-up of this episode. We didn't even get to talk about the new Literary History of America, which is awesome, and I also thoroughly recommend.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you so much, both.
Okay. Bye-bye. Bye now.
At this point in the episode, Brian would normally try and remember where he was doing stand-up at some point in the not-too-distant future, and then mention a bunch of cities somewhere in North America, and then finally realize that he wasn't clear on where he was actually going to be and when this episode was airing and how it would all fit up. And then he would just say, just check briancallen.com. So I'm going to just say, just check briancallen.com, because I will tell you that I think the kid is the funniest stand-up comedian working today, maybe ever. There's not a lot of records of ancient Mesopotamian stand-up comedians, so I don't know how good their material was, but certainly of anybody I've ever heard, the kid is the best. So check briancallen.com.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.